You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly none, and by union what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none, singly none.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Pipefitters Local 533 and IBEW Local 124. Pipefitters Local 533, being the best in the industry, is earned. Our craftsmanship, brotherhood, training, and job safety make the difference. Building and buying union creates better wages and living standards for all working families. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905, and if you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Ron Carey was the first Teamster president elected directly by the members. A new book gives us the inside scoop on the enormous challenges this union reformer faced. Author Ken Ryman will be on the Heartland Labor Forum tonight. Then, it's an election year, and corporate dollars are raining down on candidates. In 2010, the Supreme Court gave business the constitutional right to free speech, and elections have never been the same. We'll talk to Move to Amend, an organization working to change that. In the news, a wave of organizing is sweeping local nonprofits and media, including KKFI. And May is the month for filing initiative petitions. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Blockman on the life and tragic death of Fannie Sellens. And now for the news.
The news from our side, May 9th, 2024. Bloomberg Law reports that President Biden has vetoed a congressional resolution passed under the Congressional Review Act, blocking the joint employer standard issued by the National Labor Relations Board. This standard holds that workers, say at McDonald's, work both for the franchise owner and their store, and for McDonald's corporate, because of the amount of control over its franchise operations that the fast food giant has. The standard was issued by the NLRB and was then struck down by a Texas court in March. Congress got into the act by declaring the rule invalid and a bipartisan vote. But now, since it's vetoed, they would need a two-thirds majority to overrule Biden. That's very unlikely. The NLRB is considering enforcing the joint employer standard across the U.S. except for the Eastern District of Texas, where the rules apply. If they do, the giant franchisor and staffing corporations with stores or clients where workers unionize will have to sit down with them at the bargaining table. In his message, Biden said, "I'm proud to be the most pro-union, pro-worker president in American history. I make no apologies for my administration protecting the right to organize and bargain collectively."
Communications Workers Local 6360 and underwriter for the Heartland Labor Forum, has filed a petition with the National Labor Relations Board to represent the employees of our station, KKFI. KKFI has four employees. They are joining a trend in this area of media and nonprofits to organize unions. CWA is in the process of organizing KCUR, the NPR station here, whose workers are public employees of the University of Missouri, and is engaging in talks with the Missouri Board of Mediation over which employees of KCUR are in the bargaining unit. After that, they will schedule an election. In the past few years, workers have organized unions at the Kansas City Star, the Lawrence Journal World, the Kansas and Missouri ACLUs, Kansas Children's Action in Topeka, the St. Louis NPR station, KWMU, both reporters and clerical workers, Legal Services of Eastern Missouri, and a number of other media and nonprofit operations. These organizations have joined CWA's United Media Guild, and in the case of KCUR and KKFI, CWA Local 6360. CWA is also currently organizing Jewish Family Services in St. Louis, which, like several other nonprofits, including Rose Brooks Center here in Kansas City, which is organizing with laborers Local 955, are fighting the union with help of law firms that specialize in what they call union avoidance and what labor calls union busting. At KKFI, CWA organizer Tammy Chafee asked for voluntary recognition. So far, there's been no answer, but KKFI filed a petition disputing who will be in the bargaining unit with the NLRB. Chafee is hopeful that since all employees signed cards wanting to be represented by a union, that KKFI will agree without having to have a formal vote. If not, she hopes to have an election by early June. Chafee said workers like those here at KKFI want to say in their working conditions, and employers need to wake up to that. She presumes that our great employees here at KKFI want the same as well as some predictability, for instance, some predictability and rules that they can rely on, since there are always a lot of changes at KKFI due to the very democratic structure of community radio. We asked KKFI Board President Katina Taylor for a comment, but she said she's waiting to do that.
The petitions are rolling into the Missouri Secretary of State's office in Jefferson as group after group files for their issues to be put to the voters directly, bypassing the legislature controlled by right-wing extremists. In the last week, Jobs with Justice and allies like the Missouri Workers Center filed 210,000 signatures to put their Healthy Families Initiative on the ballot. All they needed was a whopping 188,257,000 signatures, but knowing that some would be duplicates or with incorrect addresses, they filed more. For over a year, volunteers, staff, and union and community leaders talked to voters all over the state about the need to raise the state's minimum wage to $15 and to force employers to let workers stay home with pay if they are sick. That's right, Missouri employers have no obligation to pay for sick days, meaning workers often go to work sick, spreading contagion to fellow workers, clients, and customers rather than having the privilege of taking care of themselves. The initiative, if passed, would require employers to provide earned sick leave, meaning you work so many weeks and you get so many hours of sick leave. Jobs with Justice wasn't the only one to bring a bunch of boxes filled with signed petitions to Jeff City. The Missourians for Constitutional Freedom, including Abortion Action Missouri, Jobs with Justice, Heartland Alliance for Progress, the Missouri ACLU, Planned Parenthood, and others delivered a colossal 380,159 signatures on petitions last Friday to overturn the state's ban on abortions. Because of interference in launching the petition drive by state officials, the campaign was delayed until late January to begin to collect signatures. The deadline was May 5th. In just 3 months, more than 1,800 volunteers from across the state, plus some paid signatures, signature gatherers, got enough signatures. It passed by the voters in November. The right to an abortion up to the point of fetal viability would be enshrined in the state constitution. The news from our side was read tonight by Michael Savoy, Judy Ansel, and I'm Stephen Hill.
Hi there.
When you're working two jobs and living in a tent, when a house costs $1 million and you can't pay the rent, when politicians say they'll help but it keeps getting worse each time the landlord lobby pulls the strings of the purse, when the human right to housing isn't even part of the debate, you know you're living in a failed state. Millions of citizens are spending half their lives locked up in a prison for trying to survive. When laws must be broken just to have a place to stay, when the prisons pay the senators to look the other way. If you have to be a criminal to put food upon your plate, you know you're living in a failed state.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Michael Savoy. I will be your host on the first half of the show. The musical prelude you just heard was from the Wobbly Songbook titled Failed State by David Robix. My guest, Ken Ryman, is a retired member of Ron Carey's local, Teamster 804 in New York City, where he was an elected business agent. Ken was a writer, publisher, and distributor for an influential newsletter, The Local Agitator. Ken, I'm honored to have you as a guest on the Heartland Labor Forum. It seems that the progressive labor community has long waited for this one. Let me start by saying what a tremendous work of love you have completed. I wish that I would have allowed more time to discuss it. Ken, could you start by telling our listeners who Ron Carey was? What kind of working class hero was Ron Carey?
Well, thank you for having me on, Michael, on the show. The kind of person Ron Carey was, if we talk about, you know, grassroots, rank and file members making it big, well, he was one of them. He started out as a UPS driver. He saw there was grievances going on, there was injustice going on his building, UPS in Queens, and he took the initiative. He ran for steward. He saw things were going on. The business agents there, the union was more, you know, go along to get along, be lucky to have a job type of thing. And he, you know, he started moving his way up. He ran for president of his local, and of course, he ran for international in 1991 as the first democratically elected president of Teamsters. So it was historic.
Yep. You could say he put members first was his key to success. But by that same token, Ken, you know, to many, he was an enemy of the state. How do you explain that?
Well, if you look at the what he did along the way, he just didn't go along to get along. He had wildcat strikes in the 1970s here in local 804, even into the 80s. And then when he became president in 1992, he took the UPS workers on strike in 1997. It was his, and, you know, people watching it on television. And you say he's the enemy of the state, it gets true, because at the end, when we won that strike, you had corporate America, they were shivering, they were shaking, they knew that stuff was happening. This is the first time it was a national strike since the PATCO strike in 1981. It was a long time coming. Mm-hmm. And they saw he was talking about, we're coming after FedEx next. We're going up to corporate greed. You know, part-time America doesn't work anymore. And he was talking, you know, in terms of like what Bernie Sanders was saying back then about single payer in 1992.
I mean,
the man.
you're breaking up a little bit, Ken. Let me enter in there. You're breaking up just a little bit. I'm sure you'll come back. But let me say that, and I probably should disclose this because I grew up with Ron Carey. In that sense, I was a UPSer here in Kansas City, and I was a part of the TDU steering committee that first interviewed Ron Carey as a co-chair. I recommended, or among four that recommended, that we support Carey, or that TDU support him, rather. So I have my earliest recollections were before that, though, were back in the 70s when we'd have to set aside packages from New York because there was a wildcat, a justifiable wildcat. But nonetheless, Ron Carey made news by not going along with the unbelievable demands that UPS placed on his workers, and thereby became that working class hero I talked about. So I remember buying Stephen Brill's book, The Teamster, where a whole chapter was dedicated to Ron Carey. What were some of the ways that he distinguished himself as an insurgent?
As an insurgent.
You know, one that was wanting to change the way we do business. Up and coming.
Yeah, well, and when he was running, he ran against the old guard, of course. He ran against Shea and Durham, and he wasn't going to play like the others played. He wasn't just going to go along and play it safe. He was going to have strikes. He was going to have contract campaigns. He brought in Ron Carver to have a contract campaign where you go after the specific corporation that you're dealing with. You have a media campaign. You're leafleting places where you're letting the people that are coming into the stores know what that corporation is doing. Mm-hmm. And that in itself was kind of strong for that time. This was the 1990s. I mean, a lot of it's done right now, but he set the standard for that. He brought it into a national scale, whereas it was just done in small places, in very radical shops. He was doing it too because he brought in some really innovative thinkers.
Oh yeah,
in the 1990s.
Again, simply by putting members first, I think is what I'm hearing you say. So much was achieved. What were some of the challenges that Ron Carey faced as a reform president in a kind of a sea of hostility? You might say all of those who saw him as an enemy of state, of course, were those who wanted to maintain the status quo. What were some of his challenges?
Yeah, the challenges were right from within the Teamsters. You know, the election was, he received 48% of the vote for the first time. So there was 52% that was not for him. So he had to deal with that. And the old guard just didn't vanish and go away. A lot of them stayed in the bureaucracy. They were inside the building with him. Some he gave a chance to prove themselves, and others, they proved themselves not to be trustworthy. But they were always trying to undermine him everywhere he went, at any time he tried to do something, even with the dues increase in 1993-94. He tried to push that across because we need the dues to be able to increase the strike allowance for strikes, and they pushed against that too, and it got defeat. Even with the one day strike against UPS, he took us out because they tried increasing the weight of a package from 70 pounds to 150 pounds without going through the contract. Took us out in that one day, and a lot of fiefdoms out there, little marble palaces, if you will, that I said, no, we're not going to go along with that strike. It's not legal and all this stuff. And, every year, stuff like that was going on. He went after their the regional conference, right? The area conferences, which was another fiefdom of theirs, another layer of bureaucracy that they could skim off. And he did that too. He got rid of that, make sure it was gone so that it put more power in the local and the joint council, instead of just wasting money on another bureaucracy and another salary.
Ken, I remember that the one-day strike. Of course, my local didn't support it. I was fortunately working an afternoon job, so the boys hit the streets because the local did not support it, ordered folk to go out to attempt to undermine Kerry, but I didn't work my evening shift. They had a handful of guys across the street from the building that were on strike, but we weren't reprimanded necessarily for that. So no conversation about Ron Kerry would be complete without the discussion of the infamous 97 strike. What made that such a tremendous success, Ken?
Well, of course, at the end, it was a successful contract that we got out of it. But what was really big, I brought up a little bit earlier, was since 1981, there was no real national strike since the PATCO. Unions were afraid. Unions were not up to going against big corporations or the government. And Ron Kerry was brave enough to do that, even though this was right after an election where it was a 50-50 election for re-election in 1996. And, you know, UPS thought that maybe it was a weak union. They didn't have any kind of leverage. But he knew
you're breaking up a little bit again, Ken. Let me jump in. To keep
he knew, it was members, yeah,
go ahead. I hear you now.
Survey early. They got a good feel of what they wanted. What happened?
No, I said you were breaking up a little bit. Continue. I'm hearing you well now.
Oh okay. But they put out surveys on the top echelon. Ron and his advisors, they knew what the members wanted. You know, and they delivered for them. They wanted full-time jobs. They wanted their pensions secure. They wanted higher wages for the part-timers, move them up to get them even with full-timers. And they delivered on it. And it put this, you know, the fear of God into corporate America. So it was
actually, very well planned. I can remember how much support we had from the public. It wasn't no accident. It was a part of that strategy that started well in advance of the contract expiration, and the ground troops, man, Kerry had people working for him, man, and people who were committed because it was their livelihood and their involvement that made it so.
Well, you said it. They had a strategy. It was a year out that they started with. You know, every month it was something new. The blow the whistle strategy was 1 month, and the safety checks. And, you know, make UPS deliver newsletter people would get all the time. And there was lots of communication, lots of transparency between the top and the bottom. And it was, which I mentioned before, but he had rank and filers on the committee, too, which was very good. They knew what was going on. They knew different issues that was going on in their buildings at different levels, whether you're a driver or a clerk or a part-time warehouse person or a theater driver. You knew the issues. So when they were talking in the bargaining, they had their experts right around them. They didn't have to go back and say, no, that's bull. That's baloney.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, man. It was, I didn't realize, well, I guess I kind of knew, but I didn't really know until I read the book, man, just what a tremendous amount of time he invested every day in his union. You know, how totally committed he was. We're talking 16-hour-plus days at times. And, of course, it took a toll on him. Well, tell us, Ken, it worked out well. Most successful strike in modern history. And then there was the crash. Could you detail or describe in a nutshell the scandal that ultimately brought Kerry down?
Yeah, that was, it's funny because the strike ended. And 3 days later, the election officer overturned the election from 1996. And there was a scandal, there was some investigation going on because during the election, his re-election 1996 against Hoffa, his campaign aides, mostly Jerry Nash and such, and Martin Davis, and there's a few of them, that it was more of a quid pro quo with some money. They wanted to raise a lot of money because they wanted to put a mailer out at the last minute against Hoffa, which sort of was late for a lot of people. The people were getting their ballots already, and they voted, and then they were getting the mail. But nevertheless, it was about funny money. They were found a way of raising money by saying, if we give to this organization, say the Citizens United or Citizens Action, the Citizens Action will be giving money directly to the Teamsters. So it was almost like a quid pro quo. Not supposed to happen that way. And we're allowed to give, Teamsters are allowed to give politically to different organizations that support you. But when that's sort of in a wink and a nod and a, you know, agree about the money coming back, then it's illegal. And, you know, they should know better, these people. I mean, these people weren't there in 1991 for the grassroots campaign. That was one of Ron's mistakes. He brought in some, you know, political operatives that were part of the Democratic Party. Yeah, they were outside the team, so they didn't really know the rules, or if they did, they didn't care. That's the way they play. But it hurt Ron, because 3 days later, they overturned the election, and a month later, they disqualified him. They did some investigation. They thought, not that he actually knew about the scandal, but that he should have known, which is crazy. But and then it went to trial. 3 years later, he cleared his name and all.
Well, describe for our listeners, man, how UPS, the IBT old guard, and the Justice Department as well conspired to undermine Ron Carey and enforce his expulsion. How did they collaborate?
There was a bit of collusion there.
Yeah,
you had Republicans in Congress. Newt Gingrich and such were in charge at the time. They were pushing for different investigations in different committees and subcommittees. Pete Hoekstra was one of the guys going after Ron.
Oh, I remember that name.
And a big part of that, too, is because Ron took the Teamsters from an organization that used to give to Republicans, and now was giving to Democrats. So it was about the funding of different parties that they were really annoyed with. They didn't like the fact that he was also kind of a radical when it comes to Wildcats and strikes and winning strikes. They didn't like that, too. But, yeah, the media that were on board with this, they weren't really looking into the things. You know, they would describe Ron as a mob boss and everything. They're the mob. We got rid of the mob, but they never got rid of that thought of every, as though every union member, every Teamster is part of the mob. And when it came down to it, Ron had to go about clearing his name. He had to get a lawyer, and he was indicted, and then he was eventually, of course, acquitted in 2001, which was.
Yeah.
For his legacy, but still, people still remember, you know, it's front page when they take down a Teamster leader, but when he gets acquitted, it's up on page 821 of the newspaper.
Oh, yeah, if there, absolutely. So the Carey trial ultimately became a modern day lynching where everybody involved knew there was no justification, yet it served the purposes of the ruling class. The details you shared in your book, I might add, were worth the cost of the book, man. Do you have any comments about the trial that could fit into our time constraints? We only got 3 minutes or thereabout, yeah. But comments about the trial, Ken, that stood out to you. Witch hunt, I don't know.
Yeah, the trial, it was quick. It also happened around 9/11. They opened the trial in August. It was over by October. And in between was 9/11, which they had a break because, you know, the world was coming, was getting crazy. There's some stories in the book about that. When Ron, he wound up, on 9/11, he wound up walking from the courthouse downtown all the way uptown across the bridge to where he lived in Queens, because there was no subway and he couldn't take it. Because he's the kind of guy, he drove his car to the subway and then took the train into the city. He was always frugal, always careful about his money. Mm-hmm. And, he was a subway taker. Yeah. Anyway, with the trial, it was a win, of course, but you know, a lot of people didn't really know about it. There was only a few people that came from the local that were attending, and a lot of them were attending under their, you know, because they knew about it and they loved Ron, but their own locally before the executive board didn't really keep the members informed about it. They didn't want anybody showing up. Of course, there was he was not allowed to have any contacts with any of the members, and the members weren't allowed to have contact with him. But some people, brave people like Tim Sylvester, Jim Reynolds, both TV owners and members, strong members of Local 804, they were there. Family members showed up. But, you know, he was acquitted, and it was big news.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the legacy of Ron Carey will stand with greats like John L. Lewis and Eugene V. Debs and Big Bill Haywood. What would you say about the legacy of Ron Carey? Ken, how would you sum it up in the last minute?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, Ron's legacy.
Yeah.
the first ever democratically elected president of the Teamsters, the man who took down, who shut down Big Brown.
Hey, I like that.
Who brought the rank and file into the boardroom.
Yeah.
And made us all proud. And I'm hoping that the young people around that never heard of Ron Carey knows the name Ron Carey.
Yeah. Well, like I said, man, it will live in the annals of labor historians as well as the minds of activists with the greats. So in closing, Ken, I want to thank you, man, for the tremendous work that you've done as I live through this era. I certainly allowed me to relieve some of my very precious memories. So thank you, Ken, for coming on a Heartland Labor Forum. And
thank you for having me.
Just wish we had more time, man.
That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck to you, brother.
Yeah, yeah.
Take care.
Puzzled by the news? Wanting to learn more? Understanding Israel-Palestine airs every Friday at 9:30 a.m. Locally produced but focused on national and international events, the hosts of UIP interview scholars, journalists, activists, and others about the ongoing conflict in Israel-Palestine. Once again, that's Understanding Israel-Palestine every Friday morning at 9:30 a.m. on KKFI.
Hey, this is Grant Conrad, and I want to talk to you a second about KKFI's Vehicle for Charity program. Do you go repair after repair on your vehicle? You fix one thing just to find another thing is broken? Well, you can actually do a tax-deductible donation of that vehicle to KKFI. All you need to do is call 816-994-7869. That's 816-994-7869.
From the album Highways, Gamblers, Devils, and Dreams, that was Corporations Are People by Hank Woji, a Texas singer-songwriter who's a proud member of the Traveling Musicians Union, AFM Local 1000. I'm Mark Galis. The notion of corporate personhood, where a corporation has similar rights to those of a natural person, is not new. The U.S. Supreme Court decided a series of cases in the 1800s which found that a corporation could enforce contracts, sue or be sued in court, and be held liable for its actions. More recently, however, the theory of corporate personhood has been taken to an ideological extreme, In 2010, the Supreme Court decided the Citizens United case, which gave corporations the right to spend unlimited amounts of money on elections and political candidates in the name of free speech. A grassroots organization called Move to Amend is seeking to change that by promoting a constitutional amendment that would eliminate corporate personhood and make clear that money is not speech. Joining us is Lawrence Abbott. He's the co-coordinator of the Labor Caucus for Move to Amend. He's also a retired Teamster, Local 70 in Oakland, and very active with the Central Labor Council in the Bay Area. Lawrence, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with Citizens United, the 2010 Supreme Court case. What exactly did Citizens United do?
Well, Citizens United was a good example of the Supreme Court basically changing our Constitution and the complete intent and functionality of our Constitution by saying that corporations, not that they're people, that was actually already done by another Supreme Court ruling that was incredibly unjust and really started the whole corruption, I would say, of our Constitution. But the Citizens United caused a huge change to happen that allowed virtually unlimited money in our politics. And it's because that corporations were already considered people, and now their money was considered to be their free speech. So that's the key, is that it's a really Orwellian stretch of the imagination. But, most all of us know that money is power, but the Supreme Court ruled that money is their free speech. And then after that, another ruling ruled that it can be unlimited free speech. So it really opened the floodgates of corporate money and shifted the power balance hugely in favor of corporate interests and away from the interests of the people, including our unions.
So what's been the net effect? It's been almost 15 years now since Citizens United was decided. So as a practical matter, what has it done with respect to expenditures by corporations in politics?
Yeah, great question. Well, the net effect is what we're seeing in real time play out, that every election cycle, more and more money gets put into elections. And it's a lot of times dark money. It's actually money from corporations that could be foreign owned or foreign influenced corporations. But the worst part is that, the money that unions can raise is limited. Our members don't have unlimited money, and we don't have offshore accounts with trillions of dollars in it. And so we're just seeing just ridiculous amounts of money in politics that that the people and unions can't balance out, and it drowns out our voice, and it often makes them come out on top over us, the interests of the corporate interests. And it's the perceived corporate interest, right? Because corporations, a lot of corporations do good. I would say all corporations contribute in various ways to our economy, but some corporate interests are certainly not in the best interests of the people.
I remember when Citizens United was decided, and one of the talking points of why it was no big deal was that, well, what are you complaining about? Corporations and unions can both spend as much money as they want, as if they're on equal footing with respect to resources and everything else. So it was sort of a disingenuous argument that, labor community, why are you complaining? You can spend your money too. It's ridiculous in the end.
Well, I think, Mark, your background as a labor lawyer probably could answer that better than I could, because all the nuances of the way that labor's hands are tied, our ability to fundraise. We have so many regulations that affect labor unions that giant corporations don't have, and either other nonprofit organizations don't have their hands tied the way that labor's hands are tied. But it really comes down to, more than anything, we just don't have the ability to fundraise the way that corporations can fundraise.
Yeah, unions are generally not as well funded. There's the Labor Management Reporting Disclosure Act, which has various limits on what unions can spend and how they report it, whereas corporations don't have similar similar policies for tying their hands. So it's really unfair footing. But I always found that to be a really disingenuous position to say that that unions can do it too. So what's the big deal? So now 15 years down the road, we've seen elections awash in money and dark money, as you mentioned. So tell us about Move to Amend.
So Move to Amend wants to overturn Citizens United. In fact, it grew out of the ruling, the Supreme Court ruling, as it was going through before 2010. Move to Amend was formed by a group of folks that saw the writing on the wall and saw how it would be incredibly destructive. But what they determined was that it wasn't just Citizens United, actually. It started a long time before Citizens United with Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, when corporations became people and started getting the concept of having corporate constitutional rights, you know, rights that were meant only for humans, but that now corporations also enjoy. So it's not just the money in politics that Move to Amend recognized that's a problem. It's also the corporate constitutional rights. So they worked to get a constitutional amendment that would solve both problems. It would the amendment is called the We the People Amendment. And right now it's House Joint Resolution 54. And it would establish that only human beings are allowed to have constitutional rights, and that money is not constitutionally protected free speech, but that it must be, in the words of the amendment, it says shall be regulated so that everyone has equal voice in our government. So it's a great way to do this. It's a heavy lift. You know, our Constitution isn't amended every day, and it took women over 100 years to get the right to vote. But, you know, we can't wait 100 years to overturn Citizens United.
Yes, it's a difficult process, probably much more difficult than it needs to be. I think it's been amended, what, 27 times, 28, something like that. So yes. So as a practical matter, how does Move to Amend work to get this amendment in front of voters, in front of the legislature, Congress? Like what exactly on a day-to-day basis, how does it work, the organization?
Great question. So Move to Amend exists really solely to pass this amendment. And so we've been working on it for a while already. And all the things that we've been doing have been working, because in every Congress, we've gotten more support from our government than we had the previous Congress. And now I think we're at 83 co-sponsors in the House. So the primary thing we're doing is just asking folks to ask their representatives to support the We the People Amendment. And we're getting co-sponsors in the House. And then we're hoping this year to get it introduced in the Senate. So we're asking folks to contact their senators and let them know how important the We the People Amendment is for democracy. And if you are a unionist, for the labor movement. And go ahead.
No, just obviously a tougher sell in the Senate than the House for a lot of these. I think of the PRO Act, how the PRO Act, you know, was you know, somewhat well received, was well received in the House, and it's just dead, languishing in the Senate. So I know that's a hard ask when it comes to something like this, especially if it's favoring labor, because that seems to be a killer for a lot of pieces of legislation.
Definitely. So what I did locally as a way to help advance this is I asked my union, my Teamsters union, to support it and endorse it. And they looked at it and did. They recognized that Citizens United is a disaster for labor. And so the biggest problem we have in the labor movement is not enough rank and file are asking their reps, their stewards, and their leadership to support the We the People Amendment. So then I brought it to the Central Labor Council with the AFL-CIO, and I asked them to support it. And we drafted a wonderful support resolution for the We the People Amendment, and it passed unanimously by our executive board and by the full delegates. So, you know, it's incredibly popular once people know it's out there. And probably the best way to get, say, a sample resolution would be to go to Move to Amend and look up their labor caucus.
So before we talk about labor caucus, I just wanted to go back to the organization itself. Like, how big an organization is Move to Amend?
Move to Amend is an amazingly small ragtag grassroots organization. It only has a handful of paid staff, But the volunteer network is astronomical. You know, we're everywhere. We have over 500,000 people that have signed the support for Move to Amend, and we have over 700 organizations that have signed on. So those are all ways that we can grow this movement, right? Organizations can sign on, and this would benefit in so many ways, not just labor, but the entire social justice movement and the entire environmental justice movement, because it's the unjust power of corporations that blocks us from doing anything that we need to do to save not only worker rights, but our entire planet.
Yeah, it's a great point in terms of the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts and the environmental regulations that oftentimes get killed because of lobbying by corporations to, you know, what's the big deal about dumping effluents in the rivers and that sort of thing that they live by. You mentioned the Labor Caucus, and you're the co-coordinator of that. So tell us about what the Labor Caucus is and what it does.
So the Labor Caucus is just doing what the rest of Move to Amend is trying to do. We're trying to build a movement. I call it the movement of the people, because it really is. It would fundamentally change our Constitution back to us. So it's all about people power. In fact, Barbara Lee, I got to ask her specifically as my congressional rep. I got to ask her in a job and an interview where we were deciding who to support for Congress here locally in Alameda County. I thanked her for being a co-sponsor of the We the People Amendment and asked her how that would support labor. And she smiled and said, oh, that's easy. It would greatly increase the power of the people, and unions run on people power. So the Labor Caucus is laborers from across the country that are uniting to who maybe need help with a resolution for their own labor union or their own AFL-CIO Labor Caucus. All the resources they need to help advance the We the People Amendment can be found at movetoamend.org. /labor-caucus. And it's a long, busy URL. Sorry about that.
No. I was actually going to ask where people could find more information. But the idea of a local, let's say, or a labor council putting together a resolution, what exactly does that look like? Is that a resolution to send to their member of Congress to encourage them to support this? Is that what you mean by a resolution?
Yeah, it can be that, but mostly what we mean is that they stand on the public record as supporting the We the People Amendment, and then hopefully not only just stand on record, but also start actively lobbying our reps to support the We the People Amendment. So the more labor unions that we get to support this, the more Central Labor Council affiliates. Then the more chance we have of growing it more rapidly, because it's either way, I see this as inevitably happening, because one of two things is going to happen. Either the people will continue to lose power and will end up some kind of totalitarian or fascist country, which we came close to a while back.
Yes.
But and we're not out of the woods. Right. We have an important election coming up. Or the people will fix the fundamental root problems and will have genuine, authentic democracy. And that's what the We the People Amendment will create.
You mentioned movetoamend.org. And then was it /labor-caucus?
That's exactly right. And okay. If they can't remember all that, if they just go to movetoamend.org, they can find everything they need there. It takes a little searching. It's a huge website with a lot of resources, but you can find everything there that you need to know.
And that's my next question about resources, like with respect to unions lobbying their member of Congress. Are there resources on there to help them do that, or what to ask or what to say that might help in the process?
Yes, all the resources are there. So one of my favorite resources that is there is called the Pledge to Amend. And that's another busy URL. It's movetoamend.org/pledge. Maybe not so bad. So around election time, all these different candidates, they come to labor unions and ask labor unions to endorse them, to support them. And we go through a wonderfully democratic process to decide which candidate will be the best for our workers and for our communities. But also individuals, they come to individuals asking for money too. I know they come to me asking for money. And so whenever they come to me asking for money, I let them know, yeah, but I want to make sure that you stand with the people. Will you please go to movetoamend.org/pledge, fill out the short candidate survey, which will identify you and put you on record as standing for the We the People Amendment and stand for We the People. So it's a fun way to get a little something if you give a little something.
Absolutely. Well, we'll encourage our listeners to go to movetoamend.org to check out the website, to sign the pledge, and to take it back to their locals in ways that they can help try to get Citizens United into the trash bin of history or ash heap of history. Isn't that the expression?
Yeah, that's what I live for. I mean, I really do live for that. I have grandchildren and I want to have hope for them in the future. Some of them have gone into various union trades and I want to know that they have a bright future before I die. And this is foremost on my list of things to do.
Well, it's great work and the organization has made great strides and hopefully our listeners can help in that movement. Lawrence Abbott, co-coordinator of the Labor Caucus for Move to Amend. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate you so much and all the work you do here.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare at hand, secure the blessings of liberty.
And we just want to dedicate that last interview to the memory of Mary Lindsay, who headed the Move to Amend chapter here in Kansas City for years and unfortunately passed away recently.
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, journeyman wireman of IBEW Local 124. Tonight, we will hear about the great Fanny Sellins, a martyr to the cause. Let's let the also great Ann Feeney make the introduction.
A widow with four children toiling 80 hours a week, found time to fight injustice and bring power to the meek. She fought with tireless energy, no duty would she shirk. Though murderers have shorter life, we carry on her work. Though murderers have shorter life, we carry on her work.
Fanny Sellins was born Fanny Mooney in 1872 in New Orleans, but married garment worker Paul Sellins of St. Louis and moved there. Unfortunately, fate saw her widowed with four children, so she took an 80-hour-a-week job at a local garment factory herself. Conditions at the factory were brutal, as the conditions in factories generally were back before unions fought for better. Fanny Sellins, despite all the challenges enumerated by Ann Feeney and more, found her calling helping to organize Local 67 of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. She soon became a negotiator for 400 women who had been locked out of their garment factory. She was so successful and inspirational that she was soon hired by the UMWA Mine Workers Union in West Virginia in 1913. Her work there, she wrote, was to distribute, quote, clothing and food to starving women and babies, to assist poverty-stricken mothers and bring children into the world, and to minister to the sick and close the eyes of the dying. When Fanny was ordered by a judge to obey an anti-union injunction, she pledged she would abide by it to obtain her release, and then openly defied it and challenged the court to arrest her. They did. The UMWA and other supporters waged a successful postcard campaign to raise public awareness and lobby for Fanny's release, with the backs of the postcards addressed to the White House itself. The campaign was a wild success, as President Woodrow Wilson himself intervened for her release. Ultimately, in 1919, the UMWA assigned her to the organizing of picket work in the Allegheny River Valley, where workers were struggling for better against the Allegheny Coal and Coke Company. Trigger warning, violence. On August 26, 1919, she was a witness to a posse of local sheriff's deputies and thugs hired by the Allegheny Coal and Coke Company, beating miner Joseph Starzaleski. Threats on Fanny's life had already been made by the coal operators themselves, but Fanny had refused to abandon her workers and leave the area. Witness accounts say she acted to intervene to protect Joseph, as well as several miners' children who were on the scene with their families when the violence broke out. Unfortunately, Joseph was beaten to death, and one of the sheriff's deputies shot Fanny four times, and another deputy bashed in her skull with a cudgel. Despite the numerous witnesses, no one ever did jail time for the public murder of neither Joseph nor Fanny. In fact, a coroner's jury ruled her death was in fact a, quote, justifiable homicide, end quote, by the agents of law and order, because they blamed Fannie for, quote, starting a riot. Despite the contradicting testimony of many witnesses to the contrary, Fannie's family and the union paid for a criminal investigation themselves, and though two sheriff's deputies were indicted, the gunman himself, named John Pearson, was never seen again. The anti-union repression and violence at the Allegheny River Valley was so bad people began referring to it as the Black Valley. Despite this, workers were ultimately successful in their fight to organize and win better conditions, in large part due to the unity and inspiration given by Fannie Sellens, first while alive, and then as a martyr. Fannie was buried at the Union Cemetery in Arnold, Pennsylvania, with an estimated 10,000 people participating in her funeral procession. Reportedly, William Z. Foster, the main leader of the Great Steel Strike of 1919, called Sellens, quote, one of the best of our whole corps of organizers. She had an exceptional belief in the workers, and she went out and organized them. She took the initiative in the midst of terror and went out to her work. Foster went on to add that Sellens was an able speaker, possessed of boundless courage, energy, enthusiasm, and idealism. She was the very heart of the local labor movement and earned the undying hatred of the employers in the benighted Black Valley District, end quote. Ultimately, she paid the ultimate price for her service, and she deserves to be honored and remembered for her sacrifice today as she was then. I hope you have enjoyed learning about the great Fannie Sellens. Have a great evening, everyone.
In the company slums of Ducktown in the summer of 19, an unarmed striking miner was gunned down by deputies. When Fannie cried out, spare his life, they shot her down as well. And hundreds watched in horror as this fearless woman fell.
And here's a news flash. We just got this from KU Students for Justice in Palestine, who say, we wanted to inform you that the University of Kansas administration has announced its intention to completely clear out KU Palestine Solidarity Encampment located at Fraser Hall at 1415 Jayhawk Boulevard tonight by 10 p.m. This comes just 2 days after the university rescinded the possibility of an administration meeting with the KU Students for Justice in Palestine, a chapter, and facilitated 40-plus police officers arriving at the encampment to seize water, food, medical supplies, and more. The Heartland Labor Forum calendar is on our Facebook page. Please look it up because I don't have time to talk about all these things. KC Tenants' 5th anniversary party, Friday, May 10th, 9 p.m. It's at the Ship, 1221 Union Avenue. The UU Forum this Sunday, Demanding Gun Sense in America with Stephanie Godfrey of Moms Demand Action. It's 9:30 a.m. Sunday at All Souls, 4501 Walnut. Jonathan Blitzer, the author of Everyone Who Has Gone Is Here, The Making of an Immigration Crisis, Tuesday, May 14th, 6 p.m., UMKC Student Union, Room 401. You need to RSVP, look up the Cock Affair Lectures. Kansas City Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting, Wednesday, May 15th, 6 p.m., Trinity United Methodist Church Basement. IBEW Local 53 Riding Group sponsor a bike ride for working family friends. Saturday, May 18th, registration at 9:30, kickstands up at 11 o'clock. Go to 1100 Admiral Boulevard or call Chad for information at IBEW 53. Jobs with Justice annual picnic, all invited, Sunday, May 19th, noon to 3 p.m., Swope Park Bandstand. Go to Jobs with Justice, Missouri Jobs with Justice, in order to register. Rally to support Rose Brooks workers who are organizing Monday, May 20th, 6 p.m. at the Borough, 8026 Paseo. Again, you can find our calendar on our Facebook page. This Saturday, the National Association of Letter Carriers is having its annual food drive. Leave a bag outside by your mailbox of canned foods, non-perishables, this Saturday in second Saturday in May. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is Troublemaker Voices from Labor Notes and Assessing the Legacy of Walter Reuther. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network of over 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from around the country and the world. Find them at laborradiopodcastnetwork.org. Stay tuned for Shots in the Night Radio Theater.
When I graduate, Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back to us too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforum@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM, KKFI.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.